I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we will have a special recorded one-on-one conversation with Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry. The first portion of the interview you will hear was recorded after the tragic events of this past weekend, a shooting in Broad Ripple that left 7 people wounded, and later the same day, another shooting that left Indianapolis police officer Perry Wren dead. The second portion was recorded before the weekend's events, but focuses on Indianapolis' violent crime problem from several perspectives. Because this program is recorded, we won't be taking calls, emails, or other messages, but we hope you will stay tuned for this important community conversation. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. This is a special edition of No Limits. It's actually done in two parts. The first part of this conversation with Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry is occurring after the weekend's events in which there were multiple shootings that we are going to talk about. The second half of the program you're going to find was recorded before those events, and we'd like to take you to keep that in mind. Prosecutor Curry, thank you very much for coming back in to talk at what is a very busy and I'm sure a very emotional time, both for you and for the city.
Sure.
Could you talk a little bit about what transpired over the weekend, what we know?
Yeah, and I can't go into any great detail on either situation. In addition to the two incidents that, of course, been in the news, the shooting in Broad Ripple and the killing of Officer Wren, there were other violent incidents as well that we're dealing with. In Broad Ripple, it was obviously pretty straightforward. The allegation is that late at night, as the reached the point where the bars were about to close, that two individuals either bumped into each other or stepped on each other's foot or something, and just led to, again, just a random, absolutely spontaneous shooting, which left 7 individuals wounded. 6 were non-life-threatening, but one individual remains hospitalized with very serious injuries. And at this time, there is no suspect under arrest in that case. There was an individual arrested on a handgun charge, but that individual is not believed to be connected with the shooting. In the shooting and killing of Officer Wren, the information is still pretty preliminary at this point, and it is an ongoing investigation. But what we do know is that Officer Wren and another patrol officer had responded to a report of shots fired, and then a confrontation occurred with an individual there, which obviously left that individual shot and hospitalized at this point, and the death of Officer Wren.
What does I want to start, I guess, first with the Broad Ripple. Officer Wren's death obviously deserves some extended exploration about what it means for our community when we have to make a sacrifice that large in preservation of peace and order. But the Broad Ripple shooting in some ways is disturbing in and of itself, in that we've got two people people bumping into each other, even stepping on each other's feet is a relatively common occurrence. The fact that they both had guns and both started shooting, apparently, what does that say about our community and really the presence of guns in the community?
Right, and I think the unfortunate reality is it's not limited to our community. Obviously, this is sort of what we've seen in this trend developing over the last several years and perhaps decades. And I talked about this to the press earlier, is that it sounds like a cliche, but to the extent that certain lifestyles are glamorized in popular culture and music, that, you know, we're seeing that play out. I mean, we're absolutely seeing that play out where, you know, the Broad Ripple shooting, unfortunately, it was not an aberration. We've had the same sort of thing in the Seamus Patton shooting from a few years ago, from the July 4th shooting downtown of a year or so ago. And, you know, that it is the unfortunate reality that there are individuals out there, for the most part, young people, who feel that this is the appropriate way to act out any grievances they have. You know, as I was thinking about this as well, you know, and particularly in the context of talking about glamorizing that lifestyle and glamorizing essentially criminal conduct, you know, what better example of that than Aaron Hernandez, you know, the NFL player who, at least as alleged, has committed a murder over someone spilling a drink on him. And so, you know, if this is the sort of unfortunate role models that some of our young people are exposed to, you know, this is what's playing out. And, you know, this sort of inexplicable violence that otherwise, you know, most of us could not begin to understand, you know, why you would get into what otherwise is a minor confrontation where if we were in school, we might have shoved each other against the locker.
Or you just say, excuse me, and move on.
Exactly. That, you know, there are individuals now who are acting out, committing violent crime.
How much of this, though, is part of the, you know, there's the cultural piece of it. There's also, you know, an attempt to recodify our laws with the whole stand your ground notion that says that if there's an offense, and we've seen it, you know, in situations like in Florida where there was a dispute at a movie theater and one guy threw some popcorn at him and the other guy pulled out a gun and shot him dead and claimed that the popcorn itself was, you know, was provocative and a threat, hurling that. How much of that plays into incidents?
Well, and obviously we have seen those instances, the Trayvon Martin case. I really think the stand the ground issue is separate and distinct from this youth violence that I was previously referring to. But obviously the common thread there is that, you know, individuals are carrying weapons, carrying handguns, and are not sufficiently inhibited to utilize those dangerous weapons.
And you mentioned that charges haven't been filed yet. Are there likely to be charges filed at some point on this, or...?
Well, there's a number of factors. Are you referring to the Officer Wren?
No, in Broad Ripple.
At this point, it's unknown, you know, whether a suspect will be sufficiently identified to bring charges in that case. It's an ongoing investigation.
Okay, so it's premature, but because I think most people look at that and think, okay. Guns come out and seven people get shot. There's got to be a crime committed somewhere along there.
Well, clearly there's a crime committed. The question is whether you can sufficiently identify the person who did that.
Who did it. Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about the Officer Wren situation. I think the thing that is disturbing about it, it's tragic in all ways, but is disturbing is that when Officer Wren and the other officer got there, they were confronted with some fairly serious firepower, someone wielding an assault rifle. I'm not going to use the person's name because I don't really want to glamorize what this guy did. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the presence of weapons like that in our community and whether there is anything we can do about it?
Well, to answer the first part of your question, yes, these weapons are in our community. And in this case, the weapon recovered at the scene was an SKS assault rifle, which had been modified into a pistol grip. I have occasion to do presentations to community groups, and we frequently use a PowerPoint that includes slides involving pictures of a large collection of assault weapons, weapons with silencers, weapons have been modified in a particular way. And the point that I make when we do that is these didn't come off the streets of Miami. These are weapons that were right here in Marion County. In terms of what we do about it, number one, to the extent that that individuals are caught with those sort of weapons, whether they've committed a instant crime at that point and have the appropriate prior criminal history of felons, we charge those individuals. We prosecute literally over 100 last year of what's called serious violent felons, and whether those carrying assault weapons or handguns, we vigorously pursue those cases, individuals who persist in carrying weapons in spite of their criminal history. In terms of what we can do about it to stop it, I've said it over and over, I don't think there's anything we can do in terms of looking to our state legislature to address it. So I think that if we're so inclined, as I am inclined, to push for reasonable restrictions on the distribution and sale of sort of weapons, we have to look to the federal Congress and hope that someday that they take the steps necessary to impose reasonable restrictions on the ability to circulate and sell those sort of weapons.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry in really what is a two-part interview. The first part, the latter part of the interview, which will air in a bit, occurred before the weekend shootings. He's been gracious enough to come back in and talk with us following the weekend's tragic events. And we're talking right now about the death of Officer Wren and the factors that helped produce that. Do we know where that assault weapon came from? Have we been able to figure that out at this stage?
No, not at this time. But obviously that will be part of the ongoing investigation. There are a number of things that are still being done right now as we speak that relates to investigating that shooting. And so that will be part of it.
Let's take a broader picture, look at this then. You know, that, as you pointed out just a couple of minutes ago, it's not a rare occurrence for these weapons to be on the street here in Indianapolis. It's not like, this is Miami or anything like that. It's here in Indianapolis. Do we know basically where they come from?
Well,
where the flow is.
In a general sense, there's the sort of twofold ways in which those sort of weapons end up in the hands of folks that we don't want to have them. And, the first is through straw purchasers, who are individuals who have the ability to purchase those weapons and do so at gun shows or stores and do so otherwise legally and then transfer them to the individuals that we don't want to be possessing them. And the other is obvious, and that is just there's a entire black market, underground market, in weapons that are stolen and otherwise moved around through those channels.
The other piece of this that is the fact that there had been, this individual who's right now alleged to have shot Officer Wren had repeated brushes with the law. In fact, it was a generational problem, and that his father had similar incidents. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I have a twofold response. I mean, to the extent that this is a situation that ultimately might lead to criminal charges against that individual, it's really not even appropriate to talk about what criminal history you might or might not have. And I guess I just make a general observation that it's somewhat frustrating that as these situations have occurred, there's sort of a broad, sweeping, general statement about alleged brushes with the law or prior convictions, when it's very, very frequently not actually the case, and that there's really not anything in any given individual's background by which anyone could predict that some violent incident might occur in the future.
We are talking with Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry in a special No Limits that actually has been recorded in two segments. The portion you're going to hear in a bit was recorded before the weekend's tragic events. Prosecutor Curry has come back in and graciously has agreed to talk with us about some of the issues arising from the shootings over the weekend. Just before we went to the break, we were talking about the sort of the background of the alleged shooter. And you said appropriately that ethically you really couldn't discuss the specifics of you know, someone who's under investigation and headed toward trial, his background, and that there often these cases get tarred with a broad brush here, and that we talk about the, you know, brushes with the law or whatever. We have talked in the past, though, about kind of a culture that, you know, and I know both you and Public Safety Director Troy Riggs have talked about holistically attempting to step in and attack lesser offenses first, to look for trouble signs that might conceivably lead to violence. Are there lessons to be drawn from this instance or the Broad Ripple one that would support that belief of yours?
Well, I think so, and perhaps not in regard to, you know, the specific instances, but just these type of instances that occur over and over. And so let's start with what we know. And what we know is that the individuals, for the most part, who are engaging this sort of criminal conduct, who affiliate with gangs, whether in the formal sense of gangs or just, you know, informal group in your neighborhood, what we know from the studies is that what young people are looking for and what they're finding by these associations is a sense of family, a sense of self-esteem, self-confidence, and so it gets to what, you know, I've talked about repeatedly is, you know, it sounds simplistic, but, you know, the starting point is, you know, we need to find a way to break the cycle of generation after generation sort of emulating that same sort of conduct. And in my mind, in part, the way you do that is to find ways to provide self-esteem to these young people other than being affiliated with a gang or carrying a handgun. And to me, that starts with commitment to early education, you know, and not letting these kids fall through the crack. I mean, you look, you know, over and over and over, you look back, and you could almost overlay the life history of any of these individuals, you know, where, you know, by early in their elementary school, first, second, third grade, they've fallen behind because they can't read, and then the spiral just continues from there.
I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, a tragedy like the death of Officer Wren. What does it do to those of you who work in law enforcement, basically? What is the emotional impact?
You know, quite honestly, for me, this weekend, since receiving the initial text that it occurred, is I've been beyond angry, and I don't know that was the response. You know, this, unfortunately, this is the third police officer who's been shot and killed in the 3.5 years we've been in office. Two others we lost through the murder-suicide, which occurred in the last 6 months. It's beyond frustrating. And, you know, it's perhaps a whole nother subject, but I'm increasingly frustrated by the fact that there are lots and lots of individuals who would give lip service to public safety. But, you know, we need to back up the talk with action in terms of making sure that our public safety agencies are adequately funded and staffed. And, you know, this my answer to your question, how does this make me? I'm very angry.
No, I can tell you're moved, even as you're talking about this. You say that there are people who give lip service to the notion of public safety, but then don't back it up. Who are those folks?
Well, clearly, you know, we need to start with adequately funding, you know, which is going to fall to our city government. I think, you know, everyone across the community needs to step up, you know, whether that's the Chamber of Commerce and the business community, you know, whether it's faith-based groups. You know, we you know, as these tragedies occur, you know, we keep having the same conversations, but you know, I And again, you know, whether it's the business community in terms of adequately funding, you know, or stepping in to assist in adequately funding our public safety efforts through, you know, the Police Foundation, both the FOP and Director Riggs have separately formed police foundations to sort of supplement the funding of our police and fire agencies through alternative means. And, you know, it's very frustrating. It's very frustrating for anyone in government, including our office, to constantly hear that we've got to do more with less. And at some point, there has to be a recognition that that's just not feasible. And we as a community have to find a way to adequately fund government services across the board and, most importantly, public safety.
There's a tremendous outpouring right now of grief and outrage over the death, obviously, of Officer Wren, the murder. Let's call it what it is, the murder of Officer Wren. What is an appropriate way for us to channel that constructively? Speaking of the lines that you were just talking about, what's a constructive step we could do to make this city safer and make police officers safer?
Oh, I know. I think I probably touched upon my primary suggestion, which is just you know, that we all need to be engaged in the process. And you know, we do that. Our police department does that in terms of our outreach efforts, and so you know that involves encouraging folks and giving them guidance on how you're going to set up a crime watch club in your neighborhood by attending the outreach programs they have in terms of crime prevention, by funding the efforts of like the Police Foundation or the not-for-profits are in that area, by mentoring a child, by being involved in Big Brothers Big Sisters. I mean, the opportunities are endless, and it's just a matter of all of us taking the initiative to participate in them.
Again, if you're just joining us, we are talking with Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry. A portion of the interview you just heard was recorded Monday after the past weekend's tragic events. The portion you're about to hear was recorded Thursday before those events occurred. We've talked at length with Public Safety Director Troy Riggs about this. I'd like to get your thoughts on what accounts for the upswing, and then we'll talk a little bit about what we can do about it.
Well, you know, first of all, there's always sort of from a year to year to year to year in any urban area, including Indianapolis, swings in violent crime and spike in homicides. But I don't think there's any question but what we're seeing is a factor of drugs, gangs, primarily drugs activity. And you see the profile of the individuals involved in these shootings. Clearly, we have a serious problem. I'm not one to subscribe to the suggestion that it's not as problematic as it otherwise be because the profile of the victim matches the profile of the suspect. You know, if we're having homicides at the rate we're having, it is a serious problem. I am encouraged by our relationship with Director Riggs. Director Riggs has proven to be absolute breath of fresh air. We have a great working relationship, but clearly we're faced with a serious problem. I share this from time to time because I think it illustrates what we're up against as a public safety community. For over a year now, we have had a project called the Non-Fatal Shooting Review Team, and it's based on a model out of Milwaukee that had proven to be somewhat successful in reducing violent crime in that city. And what's involved is that in targeted zip code areas, there is an entire team of individuals who look at each incident of shooting in a more detailed basis, not just the sort of fundamental investigation that would occur, but looking at the relationships of the parties. You know, what's the common pattern here? What's the criminal history of each of them? Not just the main players, but mm-hmm. the witnesses. Where is it occurring? And the team is made up of the police agency, it's obviously our office, probation, community corrections, the sheriff's office. And in 2013, they looked at a little over 400 non-fatal shootings in the specified area. Well, in those 400 shootings, in just at half of those, the victim declined to cooperate in any way. And so I share that pretty frequently because I think that illustrates, you know, kind of, number one, what we're up against in the public safety community in terms of stemming this violence. And secondly, to me, it confirms that a lot of what's happening is a result of this the drug trade and drug culture that you know, we're dealing with at the moment.
Well, yeah, it sounds like what you're talking about here is trying to figure out a way to combat a culture of violence in which it's, you know, considered an acceptable, almost business risk among certain segments of the community. You've mentioned drugs and the drug trade in particular. I guess, are the drug laws that we have in place helping or hurting in terms of dealing with the violent crime problem here in the city?
Well, and I don't, the drug laws in and of themselves really are not the solution, you know, because those individuals you know, unless you can identify, and I kind of want to get to this in a minute, those individuals who are entrenched criminal enterprises, then prosecuting the individual who's selling a $20 rock on the corner is really not going to stem the violence that's associated with that mm-hmm. that trade. Perhaps getting off in another area, but clearly the legislature sent the signal with the new criminal code that actually they want fewer people going to prison for drug offenses in and of themselves. And so the drug offenses I don't think really are the solution either in the short term or the long term.
Well, and I guess part of that has been a discussion at the legislative level. There have been certain legislative leaders and former state police chief, you know, who have argued that we ought to take another look at the drug laws, in part because it does create, you know, a revolving door, sending people to prison, which is a costly enterprise in and of itself. And that it creates, you know, profit motives for people to kill each other, mm-hmm. the entrenched. So I guess I'd like to take a step back since it sounds like you and Public Safety Director Riggs are on the same page here by and large in terms of talking about how we holistically deal with public safety issues, particularly regarding drugs and violent crime, and just say take a step back and say, okay, If we gave you absolute power to reshape both our laws and the enforcement of them, what would you do to curtail? You're probably not going to be able to eliminate it, human nature being what it is, but to curtail, reduce the number of homicides and violent crimes in our community.
Well, and I think I kind of have a threefold response, and actually, in part. Responding to the idea of drug offenses, because I think in terms of saying drug offenses in some, you know, mm-hmm. generalized sense really doesn't get to the issue, because clearly no one believes that someone, you know, possessing drugs or a small amount of drugs, or even perhaps, you know, selling drugs on a very small time basis, should go away to prison for years and years and years. And mm-hmm. in fact, you know, clearly our current system understands that, because we have a drug treatment court for low level drug offenses now, where essentially, you know, individuals are allowed to go into a program. It's a pretty rigorous program. They successfully complete it. Then their case is dismissed. And anecdotally, you know, we know that two-thirds to three-fourths of those people who successfully complete that program through drug treatment court never come back into the criminal justice system. So, you know, in terms of low-level drug offenses, I think we effectively deal with those already. And, you know, whether, you know, the legislature should go another step to decriminalize, you know, certain, you know, marijuana or whatever at low levels, you know, that's their call. So that kind of sort of responds, I guess, wraps up a response to the prior question. You know, in terms of where we are, I think that first and foremost, there's no short-term solution. There's no immediate solution. There's no simple solution. And so I think that in working with our police agency, our office, and even the federal agencies, I think we're taking a better, more strategic approach to identifying those individuals who are, like I said, entrenched drug dealing enterprises, criminal enterprises. And an example of that happened within the last 3 to 4 months, where as a result of a long-term investigation, it was called Operation Family Ties. It was an organization that had been dealing drugs in the 40th and Boulevard area and throughout the city for an extended period of time. They clearly, the individuals were affiliated with the related violent crime. We, by taking, again, a more long-term strategic approach, that was very, very successful. There were over 40 arrests, including every single individual who was identified as being high-level individuals in that gang, essentially, a drug-dealing gang, were arrested. A dozen of them, after, you know, our investigation with the IMPD, were actually handed over to my friend Joe Hogsett over at the U.S. Attorney's Office, who in turn were indicted on federal charges. And so in the short term, I'm encouraged by our working relationship. We had deputy prosecutors who were literally embedded with the police agencies in those investigations. And I think we've taken a more intelligent approach to the investigation. We've built better cases. And I think that model will serve us well going forward in terms of, again, and it's a cliche, identifying who the bad actors are and taking them off the street in the short term. In the long term, you know, I applaud the sort of things that Director Riggs has talked about and we've talked about as well, and that is, you know, we have, as individuals come back out of the Department of Corrections, we've got to make sure we minimize the obstacles that we put in their way in terms of a successful return to the community. Our office does that in terms of working with individuals both while they're in the DOC and coming out of the DOC in terms of their child support obligation, so to make sure they don't come out of the DOC with some enormous child support obligation, which, again, would be another obstacle. And so, you know, all the reentry programs and the sort of things that I think Director Riggs is trying to amplify on is a long-term solution. And then lastly, you know, this gets, I guess, you know, being a Democrat, it gets in sort of the knee-jerk position, but it's absolutely true, and that is in terms of long-term, you know, the solution is education, opportunities. You know, clearly we see it. You see the kids that come through juvenile who then go into adult criminal activity. You know, if they reach the second, third grade and can't read, they are on a disaster path. And so, you know, it's Marion County Prosecutor's Office can't do it, but, you know, I think from our legislative standpoint, we need a better commitment to early education. And until we, I guess, to bring it full circle, you know, that's the sort of things that has to happen to break the culture that is leading to the situation we find ourselves in now.
And it does sound like you're on the same line as Director Riggs when he talks also about making sure that those early offenses, the small ones, the bad neighborhoods, all of that kind of stuff, that there is an earlier intervention in that process. We are talking with Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry here on this special pre-recorded version of No Limits. We are not taking phone calls, email messages, tweets, or Facebook messages. Today, we are just talking one-on-one about the challenges facing Marion County and Central Indiana. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to this special edition of No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking with Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry in a pre-recorded one-on-one interview in which we're dealing in depth with the challenges facing Central Indiana and Indianapolis in particular in terms of public safety and law enforcement. Before the break, we were talking about the spike we have seen in the past couple of years in Indianapolis's homicide rate. We were talking really about the roles that that a drug culture and a drug business play in elevating those numbers. Also like to talk, when we had Public Safety Director Troy Riggs here, and he also talked about the flow and availability of guns contributing to the problem, and argued that probably we needed to change the way we approach our gun laws in this state. At that time, I don't think we had yet adopted the change in state law that allows people to bring their guns to schools and leave them in the parking lot. I'd like to get your thoughts on that in terms of our gun laws.
Well, as a general proposition, we took office in January of 2011, and virtually every gun piece of legislation that's been considered since that time, we as an office has opposed such things as being allowed to take gun on school property. In the very first year, a bill was passed that expanded the area in which or the areas where individuals could carry a handgun without a license. We've opposed all of those. We feel that reasonable restrictions on the ability to obtain and carry weapons make perfect sense. And obviously, we as the prosecutor's office has failed every single time because the legislature has been intent on pursuing this these policies that to us make no sense. Clearly, I agree with Director Riggs. The availability of weapons is troubling, and those who would say, criminals are still going to get guns. Well, yeah, that's right. They will. A lot of the black market or underground trade in guns involves stolen weapons, and that's going to happen. But it seems to me that if we can make any dent whatsoever in the availability of weapons to those that we don't want to have them, any reasonable restrictions should be considered. And as I've had the opportunity to talk about this with organizations, sadly, my response is, if we're going to get anywhere in that regard, we need to look to Congress at the federal level, because clearly our state legislature shows no inclination whatsoever to address those requirements.
One of the things that that Director Riggs said when he was here that I thought was interesting, and it's interesting in the context of the kind of creativity you've shown in pursuing common wage and other areas where you figured out new ways to apply existing laws, was to, in effect, take the other piece of the argument that the legislature, and let's face it, it's basically the gun lobby's argument, that there is a right here to own a weapon and to use it, but that also carries with it an assumption of responsibility for how that weapon gets used. And what he was arguing is then, okay, let's step up the liability. Whether you actually pull the trigger, if it's your gun, then we're going to figure out a way to try to hold you responsible for how it gets used. Are there ways within the law that you might be able to do that as prosecutor?
Well, yes, and there already are ways that can be done, and that, in fact, are done both at the federal level and at the state level. But you know, on the one hand, it makes perfect sense as you talk about it, but what's the practical implication? You know, if a John Doe drug dealer has used a weapon, the practical aspect is how are you going to prove that that gun got in the hand of John Doe? Mm-hmm. John Doe might tell you, but you know he doesn't have any credibility to begin with, and so as a practical matter, that's just a difficult area to prosecute. I mean, the one thing we've done, and we've done this since day one, is and again, this was unprecedented. We have cross-designated one of our deputy prosecutors as a special assistant U.S. attorney, and the primary responsibility of that person is essentially to funnel cases where particularly bad actors over to the federal side, where there are more significant penalties for the same conduct. So under Indiana law, we have what's called a serious violent felon. If you have certain prior felony convictions, then you can't be carrying a firearm of any sort. The feds have a corresponding crime called armed career criminal, and the penalties are just more significant over there. And so, you know, if we have individuals that you know, our police agency have arrested through our cross-designated deputy, you know, we try to funnel those cases over the Fed side, and we've done dozens and dozens of cases like that in the first 3 years.
You've mentioned, and I should say to our listeners, if you're just joining us, we're in the middle of a one-on-one, in-depth conversation with Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry, pre-recorded, dealing with the law enforcement public safety challenges confronting Central Indiana and Indianapolis. We're not taking calls or messages during this program. You mentioned that, you know, when you've talked with the legislature about gun policies, that they pretty much turn a deaf ear to what you and presumably other prosecutors are saying around the state, at least prosecutors from urban areas. Is that one of the more frustrating portions of your job, that you know you have a responsibility, obviously, to enforce the law and to provide for some measure of public safety, and your concerns don't get heard?
Yeah, there's no question it's frustrating. You know, one of the things I think we touched upon briefly is the fact that, you know, as of July 1, we obviously had a completely revised criminal code here in Indiana. And so, for example, I made reference to the crime of serious violent felon. Well, under existing law prior to July 1, that was a B felony, which carried a term of 6 to 20 years. Now, under the new code, that same offense for an individual who's got a felony history who still persists in carrying a handgun is going to be a level 4 felony under the new code, which carries a term of 2 to 12 years. So you've gone backwards. Now, with the adjustment in the way credit time is calculated under the new code in terms of what an individual might serve doesn't make a huge amount of difference. But again, in my mind, it just sends the wrong signal in terms of how we deal with handguns and weapons in Indiana.
Also undercuts the basic message that the problem, you know, if you buy the gun lobby's argument, their argument is that the weapon shouldn't be criminalized. It's the activity that's being used. And if you've used a weapon, then there should be a severe penalty, and the phrase they use is catch and release. It sounds like with this change in the code, legislature is actually making catch and release more likely.
Well, in some respects, and I guess part of my response to the whole catch and release is I get very frustrated by sweeping generalizations about the revolving door of the jail, and you know, and I always want to respond. It's like, well, why don't you give me some concrete examples, you know, of that sort of thing? I mean, clearly, you know, from our standpoint, and it gets back to what we talked about earlier, is we certainly make an effort. Our police now, particularly under Director Riggs, are making an effort, a better effort, to be strategic about how we approach these investigations. And part and parcel of that is identifying those individuals in our community who clearly are engaged in persistent criminal activity. And obviously, virtually every single time, that also involves the possession of weapons. And so if we can identify an individual who otherwise we haven't caught in a robbery or a carjacking or whatever, but he's got this criminal history and is still carrying a handgun, then we don't want that individual in our neighborhood. It's that simple.
What is the hardest part of your job, would you say?
The most difficult part of the job for me is simple to identify, and that is having an office of almost 400 people who love what they do, are very passionate about what they do, and we can't pay them what they deserve to be paid. You know, in the current climate of government financing, what we pay people who work very, very hard and do a very important job are just not paid commensurate with what their work provides.
And I'm going to ask a basic – you know, I would think that being prosecutor would be very emotionally draining and difficult, because you're always coming in when something bad has happened to somebody. I mean, the outcome – a good outcome is not really possible at that point, because there's been – harm suffered by somebody, and in many cases, grievous harm. So walk me through, why did you want to be prosecutor, and what parts of the job do you like?
Quite honestly, in 2009, not only was I not thinking about being prosecutor, when people asked me to think about running, I said no. And they asked me again, I said no again. And then finally I said yes, and now I can't imagine that I wouldn't have done this job. The thing that's great about our job is the flip of what I just said, and that is I get to come into an office every single day where there's over about 400 people who love what they do, they're committed to what they do. We have things happen every week that you can feel good about, and it's just a great place to work. You know, and not surprisingly, you know, if you're dealing with human tragedy on a regular basis, you're pretty regularly seeing things that are pretty darn funny. One that I share pretty regularly is we've got a fellow who was identified in a commercial burglary by his distinctive tattoos. And part of his distinctive tattoos were tattoos right above his eyebrows that said, "Crime pays."
Well, I guess then, you know, it wasn't deceptive advertising. Well, no. In some ways it was, because yeah. It ended up not paying for him, it sounds like. But in terms of the satisfactions, I mean, what is the greatest satisfaction you get out of doing the job itself, other than working with the people? And it sounds like you take tremendous pride, obviously, in the team that you have got. At a personal level, though, in terms of the work, the mission of being prosecutor, what drives you there?
Oh, I suppose it sounds like a cliche to say it, but just to see on a regular basis that justice is done on behalf of people who have been victimized in one way or another, you know, whether it's elderly women who were defrauded out of $600,000 by Tom Redman, as in their church through a basic Ponzi scheme, my Joe and Spencer Moore, parents of Officer David Moore, to see that justice done on behalf of Officer Moore. I mean, there's certainly no experience in my work life that comes close to the gratification that you can find in accomplishing those things.
What was the case or the episode or the instance in the office that most personally affected you?
No question, Officer Moore.
Why was that?
Just it happened so quickly after we took office. We were literally 3 weeks into taking office, and officers more was shot on the east side. And it kills me that I've had to have that experience to become personal friends with Joe and Spencer, but it was just a very transformational experience. And the other was the obvious, I guess, in terms of the Officer Bassard case, because not only the circumstances of the accident involving Officer Bassard, but in light of everything that happened, January 1, 2011, when he took office, the victims hated our office. Mm-hmm. And that's perhaps a little strong, but clearly
they
were very cynical. Yeah. They had a high level of mistrust of everything that we said. And so it was very gratifying to build that trust with them. And obviously, if you followed it, you know, we had that huge number of bumps along the way, but to finally persevere and bring that to a successful conclusion was very gratifying as well.
When you talk about the Officer Moore case being transformational, what did you learn from it? I mean, how did it transform you?
Oh, I guess ultimately the thing that has been most influential on me has nothing to do with the actual incident or the criminal case. It's just being able to see the grace with which Joe and Spencer Moore have handled this tragedy, and just to be able to become friends with folks with that sort of integrity and that sort of compassion has just been a blessing.
And you've talked about some of the challenges with the Officer Bassard and other things about restoring kind of the trust in the office and all of that, which takes me into sort of my last line of questions here, which is, what do you hope your legacy will be as prosecutor? I mean, at the end of whether it's, you know, at the end of this term or at the end of, we were making reference to other office holders who spend a lot of time in office, whether it's five terms as prosecutor, what do you hope ultimately people will say about your tenure?
Well, I think that's simple, and it just gets to the point, and that is just restoring trust in the office to know that our office conducts ourselves in a professional manner, and I feel that we do, and we've given a face to the office by really expanding on our outreach efforts, I get positive feedback. I honestly do all the time in terms of the professional manner in which our staff conducts themselves, whether it's from judges, opposing counsel, the public, and to me, that's the single best thing we've accomplished in our first 3.5 years.
What plans do you have for this summer to sort of curtail any problems, since summer tends to be a violent period?
Well, I mean, clearly we've had our input. The Director Riggs and Mayor Ballard and Chief Hyde had announced their plans for the summer, and we've been our staff's participated in those meetings, and clearly, you know, part of that is gets to what we talked about earlier, and that is identifying those individuals who are most likely to be involved in major criminal activity, and to make our best efforts to make sure that that we get those individuals out of the neighborhood.
That will have to be the last word. Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry, I'd like to thank you for being with us. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.